Look out, the world may warm much faster than we thought. That could create an energy squeeze. It's all in a new big picture study from Australian researchers. Let's peer into a real future with Professor Ben Hankamer from the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland near Brisbane, Australia. Ben, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Just the title of your new paper suggests great big topics. I mean, it's trading off global fuel supply, CO2 emissions, and sustainable development. What drove you and your co-authors to take on this research?
What drove us to conduct this research was to analyze factors affecting energy and climate security. Globally, we're facing some very big challenges coming into the future, and we need to understand these if we want to plan into the future. And one of these challenges is that our population is forecast to rise from about 7.4 to about 9.7 billion people by 2050. And to provide for this growing population, we'll have to provide more energy, more food, more water, and also reduce our CO2 emissions by 2050 by quite a large amount. So everything that we do is driven by energy, and the aim of our analysis was to establish how much energy we need into the future and what that means for climate change. And the study has implications beyond energy security as well. It has implications for our environment, social and political stability, because we need energy for everything that we do. So once we know how much energy we need, we can then determine how much CO2 emissions that will result in. And it will also tell us something about the dates that we lock into climate change of, say, 1.5 or 2 degrees C, and what we need to do to transition, say, to renewable systems.
Let's start with energy demand. How much more power will Earth's population need by 2050, and how do you know?
So it really depends on the political choices that we make. So I think the best thing to do is probably to break down this problem. The global economy is now valued at about $110 trillion per year, and that's a big number. And it's powered by a $6 trillion energy sector. Now, one thing that's perhaps surprising is that 80% of this energy is provided as fuels, and only about 20% is electric. So while good progress is made to supply that 20% electricity sector, say through photovoltaic panels and wind and wave energy, that sort of thing, we have very few solutions for fuels, and we need those if we want to deal with climate change. So coming back to your question, how much power will the Earth's population need by 2050, and how do we know? So we've accurately modeled global energy use over the last 60 years, and we use three key variables to do that, and that's population, which is rising, average energy use per person, and the global economic growth rate. So we need energy to drive our economy, and the more the economy grows, the more energy we require. This provides us with the basis to start forecasting into the future. And so now we come down to really some of those choices. So we could choose to carry on our sort of business as usual track as we have done for the last 60 years. And in that case, we might expect a linear increase in energy demand. But the trouble with that is that we leave 50% of the population on less than $2.50 a day. And that's a question of whether that's acceptable or not. And if it's not acceptable, then we have to go down a sort of more pro-growth strategy when we need a lot more energy in order to alleviate poverty. And obviously that will rise in increased emissions as well. So really, to power a pro-growth strategy into the future, we'll see rapid rises in CO2 emissions. And well, this will fast-track us into a sort of dangerous climate change zone, which the poor are then most vulnerable to. So really what our data suggests is that the best option really is to transition in an orderly manner from fossil fuels to renewables, and this will allow us to provide the energy that we need to drive our economy and alleviate poverty while stabilizing CO2 emissions. So the bigger question is then, can we provide for what we need? And so currently our fossil fuel resources are about 60 to 150 years worth of supply based on current demand. We can find more, but at a higher price. But in contrast, we get about 5,000 times more solar energy every year, which then we need to drive our economy. So making a transition to renewables now would provide us with energy security into the future, which is good for the economy.
Well, at the same time, though, as you've said, we have to cut emissions. And by 2050, which is only 34 years away, what sort of emission cuts were set out in Paris in that climate agreement of 2015?
So in Paris, there was 96 nations who agreed to stay below 2 degrees climate change and aimed to stay below 1.5 degrees, and that was mainly to protect vulnerable island states. So once this agreement is ratified, the international community can plan how to proceed with emissions cuts, and this may be defined through nation-led bottom-up approaches rather than top-down, you know, this is what you've got to do. But the answer to your question regarding the sorts of emissions cuts that we need. So CO2 is, of course, a greenhouse gas, and the higher the concentration, the more the world will warm over time. And there's a delay, and it's important to realize there's a delay between reaching that CO2 emissions level, which locks us into, say, a 1.5 or 2 degrees temperature increase, and actually reaching that temperature increase. But at that point, when you've decided to lock in at 1.5 or 2 degrees, you have to be in balance with what the Earth can absorb in terms of CO2, and in particular what the biosphere can absorb. And the numbers tell us that, from other research, that the world absorbs about 50% of the emissions from our global energy demand. So roughly speaking, to come back to your question, is ballpark figure is we probably need to reduce our emissions by about 80% by 2050, but it may be even earlier than that. So we may, if what the models suggest are correct, then by 2020, we might have to have about emissions reductions of 50% if we want to stay below a 1.5 degree climate change level. If we want to stay below 2, it might be about 50% by 2030. And it really depends if you want to go down this pro-growth strategy or whether you want to carry on as business as usual.
So it could be 50% in 4 years from now.
It could. If you want to include, and I think this is the perhaps a safe option to take, is you want to plan ahead for poverty alleviation, then according to our model, you would have to allow for something like 50% emissions reductions in 4 years. According to that modeling data. And of course you can say we're not going to do that, but then you have to also make the assumption that you will keep people in poverty.
So what kind of studies have been done to project the impact of these kind of drastic fossil fuel cuts during times of rising demands? Are nations at stake, or even the whole international security system? You mentioned security.
Yeah, I mean, energy security is critical to every nation, and we need high availability of energy and also accessible energy resources. So what that means is we need to be able to access fuels, but we also need suitable fuels to access, i.e. with the right CO2 emission standards. And really, you know, nations can't risk energy security, as modern economies would struggle quickly. You know, for example, previous oil crises resulted in long queues of getting gasoline very quickly. So if we want to transition from fossil fuels, and the climate data suggests that we have to, then we will need large-scale renewables quickly, in good time, to make sure that we have that stability and security in place. And then sadly, the data shows us we don't have much time. It's a really daunting task.
Now, a couple of headlines about your study said the world could warm much faster than we thought, and other projections have managed to place the rise of 2 degrees C at the end of this century. Ben Hankamer, what have you done differently that shows it may come sooner than that?
So let me be clear about this. So what we modeled was energy use and CO2 emissions. And based on this, what we can identify dates at which we lock into a particular temperature change. So that the numbers that we quote in the paper are that by 2020, we may have burnt all the fossil fuels we can burn and stay below 1.5 degrees centigrade. And by 2030, we might have locked into the emissions that we are allowed to burn by 2 degrees climate change. But locking into climate change is not the same as actual warming. The Earth will take a while to respond. So our model, you know, tells us that by that time we will burn those fuels, but I'm not a climate scientist, so I can't tell you exactly by which point the Earth would have warmed to that level.
Right. We've been told there's about a 30-year delay, so that right now we're experiencing perhaps 1985 to 95 emissions, and we'll find out later what happens with the emissions we're burning now.
That's right. But you will then obviously have a very tight time window to decide. If we think that 1.5 is dangerous or 2 is dangerous, then we have to make those decisions right now in order to deal with them in this 5 to 15-year window.
And I'd like to look more deeply into the concept of personal energy use, which you developed in the paper. Here in North America, we like to think personal energy use is going down as cars become more fuel efficient, bike use increases, things like LED light bulbs / utility bills. Is that assumption wrong?
No, that is actually correct. I mean, over the last 20 years, on average, we have become more efficient at producing things. So that's energy use per unit of GDP. And it is about a saving of about 0.6% per year. So we actually are becoming more efficient at making things. But the trouble is this, is that as we become more efficient at making things, these things become cheaper, and so we save money. And with the money that we save, we buy more stuff. And so in the end, we still use the same amount of energy or more energy, because there's the energy not only in the production, but also the embodied energy in the products. And a good example is smartphones. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, perhaps people didn't have so many smartphones. Now everybody's got one because we can afford it. And there will be other things like that in the future. And so energy use per person has been rising while we've become more efficient at making stuff.
That sounds to me like a restatement of the classic Jevons paradox, which was originally applied to coal. So it's still true.
It is, and it's not only true just for related to energy use, but also to the embodied energy in the consumer products, if you like. So that what I would say is that our model doesn't rely on this. We don't make any assumptions about the Jevons paradox.
All right. Now, I am assuming that a huge portion of demand for personal energy will come as billions of people in the developing world get motorbikes, electric appliances, all the things we take for granted. Was that a big factor in your calculations?
It was. I mean, the last 60 years saw a broadly linear increase in global energy demand. And we think this is because a fraction, i.e. that is about 4.7 billion of the 7.4 billion people that we have on the planet in the G20, use 82% of the global energy. It's quite a shocking number. So the G20 uses 82% of global energy. But 50% of the population, both inside and outside of the G20, live on less than $2.50 a day. And so they don't have access to much energy. So now imagine if globally we introduce poverty alleviation policies to lift those 3.7 billion people from $2.50 a day to a standard of living that we accept as normal. You might expect roughly a doubling of energy demand. And then, of course, that the population is set to increase from 7.4 to 9.7 billion people as well. And after taking these things into consideration, our model suggests that we may need up to three times more energy by 2050 than we do now. So people may criticize this and say it's not what we've seen so far, and that's true. We haven't. It's been a slower increase. But then we must have to answer the question of whether it's acceptable to leave 50% of the population in poverty.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Ben Hankamer from the University of Queensland in Australia. I guess you've kind of got a favorite in the race for this transition to renewable energy. You mentioned solar power. You think that is our major answer coming?
I think solar power is one of the major answers coming. We have vast solar energy resources, and people don't often realize this. So the amount of solar energy that we get every year is about 5,000 times the amount that we need to drive the global economy. So there is not a shortage of solar energy. I mean, there are other renewable technologies that we can use, but this is clearly one of them.
You also mentioned, though, that a lot of our fossil fuel use is in liquid form, especially for transportation. Why don't you tell us about the Solar Biofuels Research Center in Australia?
So you have to think about what are the potential fuel options that you have. And if you want to produce fuel at a globally significant level, what you need to do is hook into a large enough energy supply to produce it. And as I've just said, the sun is the largest energy source that we have. So what we're using is we're using algae, which are photosynthetic organisms and catch sunlight. They tap into this huge solar energy resource and produce the feedstocks for fuel production. You can make a whole range of fuels from biodiesels, crude oils. You can make hydrogen and methane and ethanol. There's a whole range of different biofuels that you can make. And so our focus is on developing systems which are more efficient at producing such fuels.
Are you already producing fuel?
We are. Our aim really is not to scale commercially. Our aim is to de-risk scale up. So we do work at the lab and the pilot scale. And the reason is that as you scale up, it becomes more expensive to do those trials. And so you really need to show that you've got good techno-economic and life cycle analyses done to help industry scale and choose the right options.
Now, talking about solars, I do have listeners who post comments saying renewable energy can never solve the future demand for energy. They point out technologies like wind and solar come from cheap fossil power right now and need to be rebuilt every 30 years or so, and not to mention the carbon costs of their manufacture and all the minerals we'll need. Do we have a real solution for this conundrum?
Yeah, I don't really think this is a conundrum. All energy systems have a fixed life and will need replacing. So as we gradually scale up renewable energy systems, we provide an increasingly secure long-term energy supply. And this will then be available to power our economy, wealth generation, and infrastructure replacement. And furthermore, the embodied energy is less if we use renewable resources. So I would say to your listeners, yes, we can supply energy with renewable resources. In fact, our resources of solar energy far exceed what we have in terms of fossil fuels. So the fossil fuel deposits that we have recorded are roughly in the 60 to 150 times our global energy demand, and that's sort of in total. We can find more, but then it becomes more expensive to get them. And in contrast, every year we get 5,000 times the global energy demand from solar energy.
Well, I guess in the end, most of us want to know, and I guess it may be hard for you to answer this, but Ben Hankamer, how hot do you think the world will become and how fast?
So I'm not a climate scientist, and so I feel that I don't really think I should answer that question. What we have done is we've modeled CO2 emissions, and as I say, depending on the strategy that we move forward with in terms of poverty alleviation or not, we will have different rates of global warming. But it's really up to the climate modelers to tell us, based on these emissions, what level of warming we can expect by when. But it is possible that we get feedback loops and those sorts of things.
Well, I was going to ask you about a blog called The Arctic News, where a fellow named Sam Karana added up the increase in emissions and he tossed in various feedbacks to predict warming at least 3.9 degrees C by 2026, just 10 years from now. What do you think about such a big jump in land temperature? Is it possible in the near term?
The answer is, again, not being a climate scientist, I'm not sure that I can answer it properly. But what I would say is, you know, as I said, the modeling that we've done is on CO2. Then, of course, there's other greenhouse gas emissions that will contribute to a temperature rise. We've just had reports again today that there has been very substantial Arctic glacial ice melting that results in greater warming of the oceans because the oceans are darker and less reflection from the ice. We've heard about melting of permafrost and the release of methane. Methane has a greenhouse gas emissions equivalent of 20 times CO2. So you end up in these sort of potential for positive feedback loops. And that's why climate modeling is so important. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, how quickly. But as we develop those models, we'll have a better idea moving forward. I don't know the answer to this 3.9 degrees C, but I think it's worth considering this as a possibility.
You know, reading your paper, I could see several narrow passages that we have to get through to survive as a civilization. I mean, we have to cut carbon. At the same time, energy demand is growing, and we also want to get people out of poverty. Do we have any idea when these key tests will develop, or is that up? So many variables we can't tell?
Well, so we have a critical bottleneck right now. As I said, you know, our modeling suggests that we will have locked into 1.5 as close to 2020 maybe, and possibly 2 degrees by 2030 if we have this poverty alleviation track. It'll be a bit longer if we don't. But once that carbon budget's been expended, we have to basically bring our emissions in balance with what the Earth can absorb, which is 50%. So basically, in terms of the bottleneck, we have about, according to our calculations, somewhere in the order of 5 to, you know, 15, 20 years to reduce our emissions by 50%. So this is a huge problem, and I don't know if you can quite imagine how we're going to change over energy systems to that degree in that period of time. And I think really what's critical right now is international leadership on this. Bringing our emissions under control to deal with climate change is like turning around a tanker. It will take time, and whether we have enough time remains to be seen. And the other thing is, I think it depends on perspective. You know, like if you live in the Philippines and you're faced with the massive storms they've had this year, or you're on an island nation and you're risking your survival based on sea levels, then these things are more urgent than perhaps a Western society where we can afford to, you know, put a new air conditioner in or something like this. So the Paris Agreement was a really important first step in dealing with these bottlenecks, but now we need strong international leadership on this issue. We need cool heads. And I think we need people with courage in an international scale project to meet this challenge.
Yes, I feel like people are kind of waiting to see what the other country will do, and that's not going to work. I wonder, as we wrap up here, is there a message in your work that I've missed or anything that you would like to add for our listeners?
So there is. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that you can do sort of at the individual level to the international level. I mean, first, we all have a vote. So my advice to those of you concerned about climate change is to use it wisely. The second is that we're increasingly connected economically and socially and environmentally, and each of us can take action at different levels. And many of these actions are beneficial to you. You know, installing solar panels a few years ago has resulted in us not paying electricity bills since, which has been great. And through investments like this, many people, photovoltaics have come down in price, making them accessible to people with lower income brackets. So the third thing, you can check if your pension schemes invest in fossil fuels, and if you prefer not to, you can adjust your plan. So that's something else that can be done. You can support renewables in other ways if you choose to. But the other thing that is perhaps one of the really important issues is that the International Monetary Fund estimated that we provided about $500 billion in fossil fuel subsidies in 2008. So that's about 10% of the energy market, and it's a huge number. And the question is whether governments can't use a cost-neutral approach where instead of providing these subsidies to fossil fuels, they actually use it in a strategic manner to transition to renewables. And finally, I think the thing that we need to look at is that we very seriously need emissions reduction strategies in terms of regulation, so carbon tax. It's often not a popular subject. It's seen as being expensive in a tax, but failure to do that is going to be much more expensive in the long term.
Yes, we don't have much time. We've been talking about the coming crunch of energy demand during a period of emissions reduction. All that and more is found in the new paper published in the Open Access Journal. Anyone can read it, PLOS1, and it's under the title Trading Off Global Fuel Supply, CO2 Emissions, and Sustainable Development. I'll put a link to that and other articles in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest has been Professor Ben Hankamer from the Institute for Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland, Australia. Thank you so much for your help, Ben.
Thank you for your time, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.